Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Theater Podcast, intimate personal conversations with theater's biggest names. I'm your host, Alan Seals. And given when this episode was recorded and is being released, I want to take a moment and acknowledge that Black Lives Matter. I'm continuing to release episodes throughout this whole time since I strongly believe art can, in part, help bring us together and help heal a broken society. So be sure to check out the episode notes for links to resources that need your donations if you're able to do so. This episode is with Taylor Trench, who was most recently seen in To Kill a Mockingbird. Did you know he holds the record for the most shows at the Schubert Theater? This dude has just had a career. I mean, he's still young, but he's had a career that's just been going on forever. We ventured into a great conversation about mental health. He was very open and you know, just very candid about how he's dealing with things, especially now being in quarantine and with COVID going on and everything else that's happening. And this is part of course, the Bleeding Love takeover for June. He plays Sweet William in this original musical podcast. It was actually funny because we talk about this. I was his audio engineer. I was the audio engineer for this podcast, and he recorded most of his lines in his bathroom, you know, screaming or yelling into towels or whatnot. The whole situation was just great. It was recorded entirely in quarantine. As always, please find me online, share a rating, share a review. I'm on Instagram at theater_podcast. You can find more of me at bpn.fm/ttp. And now, everybody, please enjoy this episode with Taylor Trench.
Here you go. 1, 2, 3.
My guest today has been working on Broadway since 2012, making his Broadway debut in Wicked. He's also been in the original casts of Matilda the Musical and The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. He most recently starred opposite Ed Harris in To Kill a Mockingbird and can now be heard as Sweet William in Bleeding Love, a brand new original musical podcast radio play. Taylor Trench, welcome to the Theater Podcast.
Hey, thanks, Alan. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So where I have to now ask my standard opening question, which is, where are you staying in quarantine?
I'm in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, not too far away from you.
Oh yeah, so you didn't leave town at all?
No. Oh, well, we tried for a second. We tried going upstate, and then we were met with anger and ill will, and so we left and came back to Brooklyn.
What was angry about upstate?
I think there's just a lot of fear, obviously, like rightfully so, about this pandemic and like the idea that people were coming from New York City, like one of the epicenters, and like bringing their grossness to the more like quiet, beautiful parts of New York. I think they were like, get out of here.
Well, I think like the New York as a whole is generally dirty, so we're probably cleaner now.
I think so too,
because we're conscious of washing our hands and wiping down surfaces, and like the subway shuts down to disinfect every night. So I would argue that it's better now than it is on a normal day.
I agree. I was also thinking all the people who were like, "Get out of our town." I was like, "Well, if we like maintain 6 feet of distance, there will be no problem. I promise." But we left.
Oh, well, screw those guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, screw those guys. So you're in Brooklyn now, and where did you grow up? Where was little Taylor living?
Little Taylor was born and raised in Tampa, Florida. Go on.
I lived in Clearwater for a good while.
No way.
Yeah. So I know Tampa very well.
I grew up in the same house that my dad grew up in. Like, we had the same childhood bedroom and sat at the same seat at the dinner table.
Wait, so when he got up, he moved over to his dad's chair? Is that like...
Yeah, exactly. He like assumed the patriarchal head of the table seat.
is the seat being held for you one day?
Fingers crossed. We'll see. I do have a nephew who's a lot cuter, and so I feel like my generation might get skipped and it might just get handed to him.
Oh, well, you're plenty cute, so don't...
Hey,
don't
thanks. Right
don't
back
sell
at
yourself
you.
Short. So then, in Tampa, what was your childhood like? Like, when did you get into singing, dancing, performing, like the whole scene?
super early. I was like 5 years old when I did my first community theater show, which was The Wizard of Oz, and I peed my pants opening night. And from then on, I couldn't be stopped, both peeing my pants and being in musicals.
Excuse me while I pee my pants. Well, was it your parents' idea to put you in musicals, or did you ask for that? Like, where did the idea come from?
I asked. This is the story, and I'm not sure that I believe it, but I was reading the newspaper as a 5-year-old and saw that there were auditions for The Wizard of Oz, and I loved the movie, so I begged them to take me. And the auditions were at like the local science museum, and so I stood in this like big cavernous room with like probably dinosaur fossils and saying, "This land is your land, this land is my land," and got it. Never looked back.
The fact that you were reading like newspapers and saw the word audition at 5 years old.
Yeah, like what's going on?
Yeah, well, child genius, of course.
Yeah, for sure.
What was it about, like at 5 years old, what was it about that at the time that made you really want to dig into this? Like, why not go out for sports or play in the backyard? Like most kids just want to do.
I think... Number one, I had severe allergies and asthma, so like that was going against me. Number two, I'm gay, so I have no hand-eye coordination. And number three, I'm gay, so the immediate like applause and feedback and laughter was like, "Woo, look at me!" And so yeah, I think it was like truly the excitement of like people in a room, the like immediate feedback and like getting laughs or getting applause. I was like, "More, more."
How long or how young were you when you knew you were gay?
Probably like certain. I knew for certain in middle school, but I'm sure before then there had been like inklings. But in doing community theater around like middle school time, mm-hmm. I started like becoming aware of like the gay adults or the queer adults who were doing community theater, and like started to see myself in them.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I mean. I've said this before to women and to people of color in general, and like this podcast has given me a lot of opportunity to reflect. And being a male presenting straight presenting mm-hmm. white presenting person, mm-hmm. my life has come with a level of privilege that I didn't realize until probably just like 2-3 years ago.
Sure,
really, because I grew up. In a, you know, like tiny, close to where you were, and then moved to North Carolina where it was even less progressive.
Where in North Carolina? I went from Florida to North Carolina.
Well, I moved to North Wilkesboro.
Okay.
Which is the Tyson chicken processing capital of the world.
Oh my God, you know it and love it.
Oh yeah. On a good summer day, you can smell them chicken coops all the way across the county.
Sick.
Oh, it's disgusting. And then Raleigh for about in and out of Raleigh for 8 years. Wow. That was like my home base when I was doing regional theater.
Okay.
Yeah, where were you?
I went to college at Elon University, which is in the middle of nowhere, but... that's so funny. From Florida to North Carolina to New York.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely know Elon. I went to NC State.
Of course. Blue Devils?
No, that's Duke. Duke is Blue Devils. Chapel Hill's a Tar Heels. UNC Chapel Hill. Raleigh's the Wolfpack.
Once again, gay. I relate because being queer is obviously, I can be treated differently if someone is aware of that, but I'm very much in the same boat you are, and the fact that I'm like a cisgender white guy, and so I like benefit from a lot of privilege.
Right. And I mean, I guess it's actually through corporate trainings and stuff, through other jobs and experiences, I've taken a lot of these courses in the last, you know, probably 5+ years, and it's courses and trainings and whatnot, and it's interesting to me to hear the discussions of people, especially like light-skinned people of Asian descent who are like, when they start to feel guilty for presenting more as white when it's to their advantage and Asian when it's culturally relevant. So it's like, I feel like everybody to an extent sort of puts on a different face depending on what group they're in and what...
Totally.
Yeah, and what setting they're in.
I think, yeah, even like personality-wise, I feel like we have like 1,000 versions of ourselves and we choose one to fit like whatever will benefit the situation.
Right. So, I mean, Do you still find yourself doing that? I mean, especially in, you know, like Dear Evan Hansen is one of the roles you're most well known for, of course, and among many, many other things. And Evan Hansen, the character, is just this kid that doesn't feel like he fits in and doesn't have really any friends and has this weird, estranged relationship with definitely one parent, probably the other, which mm-hmm. gets mended by the end of the show, you know. And like, so going through this experience, you know, 8 times a week for as long as you did, I mean, was it any sort of catharsis?
For sure. I think at Evan's age, I like for sure also felt totally unremarkable and like there was nothing special about me. And I think that is like kind of what's at the center of the story is that he's like, he feels so invisible, but there's a part of him that's like, maybe rightly so, because like, what do I have to contribute? I think even if you're like the quarterback of the football team, like that is bubbling inside of you somewhere where you're like, maybe I'm not special. Maybe like maybe I'm like not worth celebrating or something. And I hope, and especially with the song that ends the first act, You Will Be Found, I hope that the show teaches people in the audience that everyone absolutely has something inside of themselves that is like singular and special and deserves to be shouted from the rooftops.
Well, it's nice to hear that. And I've heard people say that a lot. And then immediately, like the next day, I'll be talking to a Tony winner who's like, I don't know why I have this heavy piece of metal. I don't deserve this. I'm no special than it. Not any more special than anyone else. And it's like, I love how theater and the performing arts kind of in general attracts this type of person that just quietly needs, and sometimes not so quietly needs validation. And then when they get it, it's so hard to be happy with it.
Mm-hmm. I was told someone this recently. I feel like inside every theater artist, there's one version of themselves that is like, I'm the worst person here. Like when I step into a rehearsal room, I'm the reason this project will fail. I'm going to like tear us all down with me. But then there's another part of you, like this tiny version of yourself that's like, but maybe I'm a genius. Because I think you have to have that in order to like keep going after what we do. It's like too hard to not. And I think in order to chase it, there has to be like some tiny part of you that's like, I think maybe I'm incredible. And it's so true. It's like those awards season like feeds into that for a second. It like feeds that part of you. And then immediately you like squash them down into the dirt and like, once again, welcome back the part of you that's like, I deserve to be in a crate in my basement.
you've had the pleasure too of, or the not pleasure, what's the word I'm looking for? The privilege of originating multiple casts. Originating a couple of casts and you know there's still there's thousands of actors in this city, tens of thousands probably. I don't actually know the statistic, and the vast majority never get to say they even originate one,
right?
And so you've got more than one, and then you've got the credits that are two of the biggest shows still running on Broadway. We'll say still because Broadway will come back, and I'm sure Evan Hansen and Mockingbird will come back. And so even after all of that sort of thing, like I realize that it sort of becomes norm and it sort of becomes habit that, you know, like, oh yeah, I got Ben Platt on speed dial and I can just call up Lin-Manuel or whoever it is, right? And Ed Harris and I are buddies. But do you ever stop and just realize where you are and just say like, this is not average?
Right. That's so funny. It does become so normal so quickly. And I think anything, like once something becomes your routine, that just is what's normal to you. So I make it a point to try to remind myself to be like, look at where you are, look at who is like standing next to you on this stage. And there have been so many events since I've moved to New York, like within different experiences of doing shows, there have been so many like single events that have reminded me of that. Like, when we did To Kill a Mockingbird at Madison Square Garden for like 20,000 public school students, mm-hmm. that was a moment that was, I'd been lucky to be on Broadway for like 8 years. And then suddenly being in Madison Square Garden doing a Broadway play and like really taking in who I was on stage with and the power of theater and like remembering seeing young people fall in love with theater. It was like such a cool reminder. And I feel very lucky that I have moments like that that can remind me of how cool Broadway is.
How long was that in the works before it was announced? And then like the rehearsal process, I mean, did they move the set or did they rebuild the set or build a new set in Madison Square Garden?
Yeah, they built a new set. We fully restaged the show. So we would be doing like the original version at night at the Schubert Theater. And then during the day, we'd be in Long Island City rehearsing a fully new version of the show, which was kooky. I don't know how long it was in the works. We found out very last minute. Scott Rudin called us all on stage either before or after a show one night. And we were like, oh no. Cause usually when a producer comes for a cast meeting, it's like, you're all done for.
That's what I was going to say. It sounds like you're getting your closing notice.
I know. I was like, oh no, wait, I thought this was a hit. gosh, darn you, Ed Harris. But then he was like,
I did close the show. It was me.
So we got like, it was very last minute. He told us the news and like days later we started rehearsals. But it was just so exciting. My gosh.
Yeah. I can only imagine. I mean, I've seen shows in the audience in MFG and I've never even sat on like bought a ticket to see a show or anything on the floor. So,
me neither.
Oh man, like that has to be absolutely incredible. And you mentioned the Schubert, like you have the record for most Broadway shows at the Schubert Theater.
Yeah, take that.
Take that, everybody else.
Yeah, Bernadette Peters.
Patty who?
Yeah, Patty Lou, no, more like it. Just kidding.
Patty's going to come after us with pitchforks. Yeah. You know she will. But you've also had a wonderful, wonderful benefit of performing with your boyfriend, Ben Levi Ross, in Dear Evan Hansen. What was that like?
Wonderful. We met, he was an understudy for like all of the teenage boy characters when I joined. And I walked into the rehearsal room and was like, hubba hubba. But I like pushed him away and was like, no, we're not going to I'm not going to date somebody I work with. And then he tricked me into go seeing a movie. And he was like, we're all going to go. The whole cast is going to go. And I was like, okay. And then as I walked up to the movie theater, he was like, everyone canceled, but he had never invited anyone else. our relationship is built on lies and deceit. But he was like, I first of all, just think he's so incredibly talented. And so it was so fun to be on stage with him just as someone who like that I admire and respect, but then yeah, the added bonus of like it also being someone I love dearly, it was such a treat.
Do you have any, or did you have any sort of issue with like if there was any trouble at home and leaving it at home and not bringing it on stage when you needed to like each other?
I don't know, like maybe it's a sign that I've been lobotomized or something, but I like we don't have conflict. It's been. I mean, I say that and like tonight he's going to put a pillow over my head and smother me and been, like building resentment that I just haven't picked up on. But we like are not we don't argue or like if anything, he just gets annoyed at me for like being dumb around the house. But we very luckily we're always like, we're able to come to work in a happy, healthy place.
It's interesting to me to like I read scripts and read books and see shows and you know artists, the writers who create these works are using this as methods of expression and communication. And when I see like on TV or something, you can't beat around the bush for too long or the plot gets stale and you get bored and you have to move things along. But in life, sometimes people go years and years without saying what they really think or what they really mean. And I try to carry this over to my personal life is as forthcoming and honest as I am in like a written form, or even like I find myself being more vulnerable right now doing podcast interviews. Mm-hmm. Than I do with friends that I know I'm going to see every day, like my daily circle of close friends. Do you know what I mean?
100% yes. There must be something about like the podcast, you ultimately know it's like for entertainment, or like it's going to be like released to a, like a larger audience than just your circle of friends. And there must be some weird like permission you give yourself when you know, especially when there's a microphone. I feel like ultimately it becomes a microphone is like a signifier that this is a performance in a way or something. And that must like give you permission to be like, okay, because I'm like at a microphone doing a podcast, that then like gives you a little bit of room to be more open and honest or something. I don't know.
I don't know, but it seems to me like sort of backwards, because we're digitally recording intimate things to put out on the internet that will be there forever.
I know.
Yet sometimes you can't just like go up to somebody you really love and just and say something that you think they're not going to like.
Yeah.
Because speaking for myself, it's like I have to continue to see this person, I guess. I live with this person, or, you know, in a lot of cases, like we have kids together, we have property together, we run a business together, whatever it is. And for me, it's like, I'm just afraid of like saying something and making them not like me, because then we'll never get over it. I guess it's a lack of confidence that conflict can be overcome easily.
Yeah. And I guess it's like a deeper investment in your personal relationships than in like the audience of a podcast. Like, you're obviously like, it's much more high stakes to like be open and honest with the person, like the most important person in your life, which feels like the opposite. It should be the opposite. You're right.
Well, it's a commonality I've heard, and I can vouch for this myself too. Having performed back in the day, that it's much easier to step on stage in front of 2,000 than 20.
Oh yeah, my God. I think about all the times that like growing up and going to like family reunions or like Thanksgiving at my grandparents' house and then being like, sing us a song. Like, that makes my face so hot. It makes me break out in hives more than doing Madison Square Garden did.
Right.
So spooky.
Yeah. Well, there's anonymity. And I was just actually talking Mark Kudish about the differences, girl from the North Country moving from off Broadway to Broadway, like it's a bigger house. And he was saying too, that like the first third of the audience, he didn't think had a great experience, because they were in the light. They were, you know, too close. They were trying to like get back to see the full picture, because it's a show that requires like a big vantage point. So I totally get that. It's uncomfortable for me too, as an audience sometimes, when I know that, I was going to use six as an example, but I think that's a bad example. What I was going to say was, when I know that they're looking at me.
Oh God.
And, from on stage as an audience member. But six, now as soon as I said that, I was like, oh no, six is okay. Because from the beginning, it's concert style. They're supposed to be looking at
right.
you.
Like, that's the agreement.
But like, right. So there immediately, there's no fourth wall. They're just like, here we are. We're telling you a story.
Right. And there's nothing worse than going to see a play where you think there's a fourth wall, and then suddenly the characters like turn out to you, and like you're like, ah, no, like this is not what I signed up for.
Like the end of Cats. Should we go there? Yeah,
the end of Cats. Don't dare look at me, Judi Dench.
Not once. Not thrice. Not twice. But thrice. Really, Judi Dench?
Like, no, let me escape. I don't want to be like part of this.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Well, speaking of escaping,
yes.
Bleeding Love, The Bleeding Love, you are Sweet William in this original musical podcast radio play. And we're seeing it like in the podcast world, podcast has just exploded in the last 2 years as a medium. But now there's this resurgence of radio plays that are coming out. And I love it because when you think about the form of entertainment that's audible, that's why books, a lot of people are like, books are so much better than movies because books leave so much more to the imagination. Mm-hmm. And I think radio plays too do something very similar if they're done very, very well, obviously. And Harris Duran, the writer and lyricist and also edited all the podcasts, yes, did this magnificent job of putting it all together and creating an atmosphere with the Foley and the music and the sound effects and whatnot. And I, you know, for those listening, I was one of the producers on the thing and helped do the audio engineering. And so it was very fun and challenging to work with you and work with the other casts. To recreate a sound studio for you was in your bathroom.
Yes. I know. I should say, I don't know if this has been said enough, but Alan is the reason we all sound good on that podcast.
Thank you. It was fun. It was a fun challenge and recorded entirely in quarantine, yes, which is ironic because the whole show is about being in quarantine.
Right.
Which it was written years prior to the current pandemic and just happened to fit the current world. So we were like, we have to produce this and we have to get this out. So, but how did you get involved? Because this has been, you were in the original demo recordings that came out in 2016. And then, so 4 years go by and now we have a pandemic and we're recording you in your bathroom.
Right.
So how did it start for you 4 years ago?
After hearing you say that they wrote this so long before this all happened, now I'm like, should I ask them about lottery numbers or when should I buy property? We should all be seeking counsel from them. I got invited to do the demo recordings. I think I was doing the Curious Incident at the time, and I honestly don't know how Harris found me, but he very kindly asked me to record the demos and he sent me some of the original production, which was in Denmark, I think. Mm-hmm. He sent me some of the music from that and I was immediately so compelled because it truly runs the gamut from rock and roll to classical. So I agreed right away to do the demos. And then, when Broadway Podcast Network so kindly offered this show a home, they were able to assemble the full demo cast back together, which was so great, but also so painful to have to listen to what I did years ago and then try to match that. I was like, yeesh.
Well, it's interesting because, you're not old. I was gonna say as young as you are, you're not super young, but you're not super old.
Hey, watch it.
People's voices are still changing.
Yeah, it's true.
And so even the timbre of people's voices, I mean, maybe Sarah Stiles can always go back into that voice that she's got. But we had a tough time matching a lot of that, Tony Vincent too. You know, Mark is of a certain age where I think he was all right. But I love you, Mark. And so it was interesting because there was some dialogue that was interspersed with the music back from the demos, mm-hmm, that we had to then cut out and re-record. And it was this incredible challenge. And for you, have you ever kind of done anything? I mean, obviously we're all living through a pandemic for the first time, but recording in your bathroom, doing these one-off lines. We didn't record lines against any other actors. It was just one line, one line, one line, and then it was all spliced together in post.
Right. Yeah, it was such a unique challenge. There were moments where we were able to see each other on thanks to technology through Zoom and stuff. So we could at least see them and sort of have something to react to. But it was so absolutely bizarre to try to make a specific, honest choice with sort of no context.
Well, how did you approach it? Did you approach it differently than you would any other role just because you're by yourself this time?
Yeah, I think so. I guess I don't know what I was doing, honestly. I feel like I just blacked out for the 8 hours and like screamed into my microphone at home alone. And my neighbors were probably like calling the cops. I don't know. I guess it was about like finding, just making any sort of decision on your own, like trying to find any sort of specificity or detail to infuse with the lines to like make them sound alive. Because yeah, without that like exchange of energy that you get in like acting with someone on stage, you have to sort of like self-generate that energy, which is hard to do.
Well, that's why, yeah, you mentioned the visual help. Like we got on Google Hangouts and that was specifically why we tried to do that. It is just very much so that even if we weren't, you know, like it didn't have you reading against whoever your scene partner was, mm-hmm. if scheduling didn't work out, then Harris was reading or somebody else was reading. So right. Like to get some sort of interaction. And it became to me like recording voiceover, where it's like, all right, mm-hmm. let's do four different takes of this line, four different ways, and then we use the one that fits.
Right.
So, you know, so again, like talking about Harris, how he put this all together to make it sound completely seamless, just he did such a good job. And all of you two, all of the actors did too. Like the amount of variation and the range that you went through and the options provided, I mean, it's how it came together is just incredible to me.
Thanks. I'm happy about it too. I guess also there must have been something about, because we all knew the story for years, like we'd all record these demos so long ago, even if it wasn't like at the top of our brain, it was like living somewhere inside of us, like subterraneously. Is that a word? Delete this. Cut me out. Delete this podcast. Don't release it. It was like
subconsciously.
Thank you. I knew that, and I was testing you, and you passed.
Thank you.
But yeah, like the story was already living inside of us. So I'm sure that was also a big help, and that we at least like generally knew the trajectory of what was supposed to happen and like what the like goalposts were throughout the show.
Well, where do you think it should go next? And in a related question, when theater comes back, do you think it's going to be something that incorporates more of this digital format, or do you think it's going to go back to everybody just show up to Broadway and get some overpriced pizza and water and go see a show?
Wow, I would love to have more pizza on Broadway. I definitely think that this will continue. I as technology gets better, we just see more and more people participating in it. I feel like there is like a record number of podcasts, but yours is the best, and you can put that. Send that to the government. I don't know what that means. I definitely think that this will still be relevant and ever present. But I think the main thing that will change is whenever it's like safe to be in a Broadway house again with other people. I think that as like technology becomes cooler and more developed, I feel like theater will start to get stripped back further. I feel like things are going to go to more of like a Peter and the Starcatcher-y kind of place where, like you said about radio plays, the audience is going to be more required to use their imagination and like be more engaged with the play. Because I don't think we can ask people to pay as much money to come see Broadway shows right away when we return. And I think producers probably can't spend as much money. So yeah, I imagine that we're going to come back to a world that is like much simpler stuff on Broadway.
I wonder if it's going to be like sort of a hybrid streaming format, physical streaming format, because that's always been a question of mine, you know, and I know why, I was going to say, why you don't stream, offer the ability to watch live performances on the internet while they're happening or whatnot, like for people who are never going to be able to, for whatever reason, come and see Hamilton or Dear Evan Hansen or Mockingbird or whatnot, giving them a way to see it. And Hamilton, like Lynn's changing the game. Like Hamilton right. is about to be dropped on Disney right?
Plus, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Disney Plus in a couple of weeks. And so that's changed. And now in the pandemic, like Broadway HD and other streaming services are offering recordings of shows. But I really wonder how this is going to shape out when we come back, because you want people, like New York City, part of New York City thrives on tourism, and the entertainment industry mm-hmm. is all about tourism and you know, getting people to see shows and walking through and everything. And if Like, for how long are we going to be able to open houses but not have a full house because you have to maintain social distancing? So for half of the house that would have been there, can they pay to watch it online? How do you prevent copyright violation? Like, people still go into movie theaters and, you know, with camcorders or body cams or whatever and record this stuff. Mm-hmm. So is that where theater's going? Are we going to be able to get more bootlegs and still the purists want to go see it in person?
Right. I don't know. I feel so... I'm so conflicted about that because on the one hand, I wish that theater could be more accessible for everyone. Mockingbird putting on, having students come see the play for free is like, I hope there are more initiatives like that in the future, because I don't think that recording a show on film, I know Hamilton will be beautiful, but it's just not the way it was supposed to be experienced. It was like directed for the stage and performances are calibrated for the stage. And there's just something, what makes theater so special is that it exists only in that moment with that group of people in the audience and like whatever happened on stage that night. And that is like what makes it a unique and beautiful art form. And I think when we record things that like just a lot of the mystique goes away and the magic goes away. But then there's also something great about people watching Hamilton at home. It'll probably like introduce a new generation of people to Broadway musicals and they'll fall in love. And then hopefully eventually they'll come see something in New York or on tour.
Well, Hamilton's been open 4 years, right? 2016. Like that, yeah. It's like 4 or 5 years. So, you know, they've got the reputation of having, you know, being the top grossing show on Broadway for so long. Mm-hmm. And that's something that people still want to go see, its reputation. So I wonder if it's going to make sense for them to continue to keep it on Disney Plus when the theater reopens as opposed to like Six. It didn't get to make their Broadway debut because that was the night Broadway shut down.
Right.
They would be cannibalizing their own audience to put that online before a year or so go by, or like Mockingbird is doing well too. Are they going to start doing it? Or, you know, Evan Hansen's another one of these long running ones, or you've got like Wicked and Phantom and these shows that have just been around forever that people want to come and see because that's like a staple of I went to New York and I saw a Broadway show and it was Phantom and that's what I see every time. which, by the way, side note, I want to go off on a tangent right here. Before online ticket sales, I would stand in line at TKTS to get my discounted tickets. And this was in the age of Peter and the Starcatcher. This is what reminded me when you said it earlier. And for whatever reason, I look approachable and I have tourists come up to me every time I would stand in line. And they were like, hey, what should I go see? And I said, well, you can go see this, but there's this other great show, Peter and the Starcatcher. And I personally saw it like 5 or 6 times. I loved it. I saw it with Christian Borle and it was just, oh my God.
So good.
And so I was looking at the show and I said, Peter and the Starcatcher, a story of how Peter Pan became Peter Pan, and it's an origin story. It's so good, it's funny, and it'll make you happy. And they're like, well, I'm gonna go see Chicago. I've heard of that one. Or yeah. I'll go see Phantom. I know what that's about. And the ability for people to not take a chance on something that they've never heard of that is just as good or better. Right. Nothing against Phantom, nothing against Chicago, but like those will always be there.
I know. It's the like familiarity of a title, especially for how much money it costs to see a Broadway show and how much money it costs to fly to New York for wherever you're coming from. It makes so much sense to me that of course you're going to like go with what you think is the safest bet. Cause you're like, I want to make sure I get my money's worth. So I think that's also something, it's so important that we like find a way to have more accessible Broadway ticket prices, because I think that will then make people feel more comfortable going to see something like a little more experimental.
Well, this is a much bigger conversation, and the ticket prices are high because the production is high because rent is high because property taxes are high because New York, New York, New York, New York. And there are, like right now, so many people are moving out of the city, leaving the city because of the pandemic that like there has got to be a real estate crash coming. And when everything reopens, restaurants have to go first because people need a place to eat, and public transportation needs to be there so that people can get around. Mm-hmm. And all of these things, like if there is an ongoing pandemic where we just have like mutation after mutation of outbreak after outbreak, then this stuff, the hole in the wall, amazing ramen place around the corner can't have 20 people stuffed into 2 square feet anymore because of whatever law is going to happen. So do they go out of business? Do they change? And houses, are theater houses going to have every other seat removed because of social distancing? I mean, this is so crazy what we're living in right now.
Yeah, and there's like, it's unprecedented, and we have no, I like spend all day like reading and speculating about what will happen, but like we just don't know. And so that's what's so scary about it all. It's like, we don't know when it'll end. We don't know what life will be like when/if there is an end. Like,
Well, do you really focus on it? Do you read a lot about it all day?
I go in like waves. There are times when like I look at my phone at the end of a day and the like notification that tells you how long you've been looking at your screen. There are some days when it's like 8 billion hours. And then I will like have a couple of days where I just put my phone away and try to ignore it all. But yeah, I feel like the more I read, the more I know, the better I feel.
Well, is it like a sort of an, do you get anxious when you don't know or get anxious the more you do? Because the people in my family are like kind of both. They're like, I know something's going on. And then the more they read about it, the more anxious they get. And I'm like, I can't talk to you about this. You're stressing me out.
I think there's something about like the initial part of like disconnecting yourself from the conversation. There's like the first few moments of that where you're like, like finally my like mind is happy. But then you start like, as you're like going to sleep at night, you like start falling into a tornado of the unknowns. And so for me, I feel way less anxious when I have like more information at hand.
Is like anxiety something that you deal with like on a regular basis or just this sort of situation?
Just this. It's really, made me like a little more understanding. I am like not at all an anxious person. I like swing more towards the depressive side of the spectrum, I think. But so many people in my life have like anxiety disorders. My boyfriend, a lot of my like closest friends. And I feel like this, I was like describing how I was feeling to Ben, my boyfriend, recently. And he was like, oh no, yeah, that's anxiety. That's like what I feel. That's what I feel every day, like from start to finish. And I was like, I know. And it took like this global pandemic to make me see that or understand that.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. I'm with you. I am very much like, okay, something's bothering me. I'm just going to work my ass off and then I'll go fix it. Uh-huh. And either I work enough so that I'm not thinking about what is going on, or I actually do like put forth solutions and fix it. And I've always been kind of that way. And it was like 2 weeks ago when I just sort of just sat down and was like, I think this is helplessness. Mm-hmm. I don't know quite what to do and I'm not motivated to do anything. Mm-hmm. And it was really weird because I am trying now to sit in my negative emotions because, you know, through recent years of therapy, I'm like, okay, now I'm okay. Don't push it away. Don't ignore it. Acknowledge it and
like experience it, honor it, and then let it pass, let it wash away.
Yeah, and it really did. Like I this is one of those things going back to the beginning of our conversation where I told my wife, I said, I think I need like a couple hours just like to be by myself because I'm not in a good place right now. And I previously have been afraid to say things like that to people.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Because I don't want her to say, be like, oh, that weirdo, he's that crazy guy I married. Because it's just a fear. But yeah, like it felt good.
Yeah.
And I sat with it and then I was like, okay, cool. Yeah. Now I know. All right. Now I realize what a lot of other people are feeling. So now I can empathize with them.
Yeah.
The world is better.
Yeah. I so relate. I'm the very same way where find it so hard to ask for something like that because going back to what we were talking about earlier about how much harder it is to be vulnerable with like your partner or your friends or whatever. Yeah. It's like this fear of disappointing them or letting them down or like you said, becoming unlikable or unlovable. I am learning to like get rid of that behavior and just say what I mean and ask for what I want because almost every single time the like response you get is like, yes, that was good. And thank you for telling me. And that's totally fine that you want to go be by yourself.
Which why we keep hearing positive reinforcement. Why is it ingrained in our heads to be like, well, this time's going to be different. This time's going to be different.
Because we're a nation filled with shame.
Oh, God. Yeah, we are. I think as a nation, we need to get okay about talking about mental health.
Yes, 1,000%.
It's just been like exploding. Like the last 2 years, it's all of a sudden just become something that, oh, yeah, I got therapy. And, I met a friend a couple months ago before quarantine was, and we were having dinner, and I had just come from, a therapy session, and he was like, oh, you know, where'd you come from? What were you doing earlier today? And I immediately went to a place where I was going to say, just hanging out, you know, just kind of give like a vague answer. But in that moment I said, you know what, let me just see what happens if I'm actually honest. And I said, well, I just came from therapy. And the guy said, oh, do you like your therapist? I'm looking for a new one. And I was like, that was not what I expected at all. That's awesome. Yeah. So I just wish more people would be honest. And it's gonna take a while. Because my parents' generation, our parents' generation didn't do that.
Completely. It was,
yeah.
It's so true. I do feel like we're on our way though. Things are obviously like looking up and we're like taking huge strides to remedy that, I think.
I do too. And it makes it, technology makes it easier. Mm-hmm. And it's funny too, because Google publishes a lot, they'll publish search trends a lot. And there was somebody, a presentation I watched once that was like, even after, on Mondays and like 2 days after daylight savings, when that 1 hour shifts, the queries about like how to commit suicide jump up temporarily.
Whoa.
Yeah.
My gosh.
Yeah. So it's like people tell Google, I mean, it's not, Google's not Big Brother. Google's not spying on you. I'm not going to say, like, whatever I say next, people are going to be like, damn, with the corporation. Anonymized data that works on trends. But when, you know, you search for something like, how do I French kiss? How do I make a muffin?
I see you've been reading my Google history.
How do I French kiss a muffin? What is the best way to clean blood off a floor? Yeah, there are things that you put into the internet that you would never tell a person.
Totally.
If when you take that data, you anonymize it, and you can then start showing recommendations of like mental health help, mm-hmm. or resources to help people get better. Or maybe it's podcast results. Maybe mm-hmm. it's like a self-help podcast, or Bleeding Love, a podcast about being in quarantine that has a nice message. You know, it's a message about love. Like maybe that's something that should be surfaced in search results based on someone's previous search history. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think there's like, we're just kind of at the tip of the iceberg to how useful machine learning tied into emotional response is going to get.
I agree. I think in such a big way, also even the like access you have to other people is so huge. I feel like for the queer community in a big way, being able to like talk to people on the opposite side of the globe and have a shared experience with them when in your own small town, there's like maybe no one you can relate to. That is also like, I think one of the most incredible things about the internet.
Well, yeah, you can turn on your computer, listen to a podcast, listen to stories, whatever it is about people. You can find people like you if you like eating bugs upside down while wearing a furry suit or wearing a bear suit. Then there's somebody else out there that's going to want to do that too. You know, how do I find insect eating bears parties?
Yeah. and if you want more information for that, you can subscribe to my podcast, which will be launching soon here on the Broadway Podcast Network. Stay tuned.
I would listen to that.
Thank you.
Just saying. Okay, so we are short on time because you have a heart out here. So let's wrap up as much as I don't want to. I love this conversation.
Mm, right now.
Get to my three questions here that I use to close out every episode. The first one is, what motivates you?
You do. What motivates me? That's a great question. Takes a lot. I'm a procrastinator for sure. I can be so lazy. I guess what motivates me is, I truly don't know. Like, this is such a gross answer. Like, storytelling. the shared artistic experiences are what motivates me. I don't know. I feel so like I'm playing a flute in a field with a flower crown on my head.
There's no wrong answer.
All right.
The second question is, what advice would you give to your younger self and younger people listening now starting out down a similar path?
Yes. I think it was so hard for me in the beginning to deal with rejection, which is such a big part of doing what we do. And I have recently learned to shift my method of thinking. And when I get something that I wanted, yes, it's okay to be sad. Yes, it's disappointing. But at the same time, someone else's dream came true. And that is wonderful and exciting and should be celebrated. So I think that is something helpful to hold on to when you're feeling down. And also try not to compare yourself to other people. I always hear people say it's hard to move forward when you're constantly looking side to side. So it would be don't compare yourself to other people, and also please celebrate other people's successes.
Okay. I like that.
Thanks.
So now, last question. If you could only see one show for the rest of your life, but you could see it as many times as you want, what would you see?
Oh my God. Does it have to be currently running?
No.
Oh my God. This is a really difficult. My first instinct is The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime.
I love that show.
Me too. But because I shared the role with Alex Sharp, who won the Tony for it, we both got to see it a lot from the audience. And I just never, ever got tired of watching it.
I didn't know that. There was an alternate?
Yeah, I did the show two or three times a week to give Alex a break, just because it was so physically and emotionally emotionally demanding.
So you only do shows that are so emotionally and physically demanding they can't
be
done.
It requires two actors, exactly. And I do feel that not having to do 8 shows a week, doing six shows a week, it really is the answer. That's what we all should be doing.
That would give more people jobs.
Yes, I agree.
Keep more people healthy, give more people jobs.
Yeah.
All right. Maybe that's the answer.
Boom.
After quarantine. In Australia, a lot of times they do 9 shows a week.
Oh! Why on earth?
Yeah. Yeah. I just finished interviewing a bunch of 6 queens from the Australia cast.
Oh my God.
And they were like, yeah, we did 9 shows a week in Sydney.
No, don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Insane.
Too hard.
Yeah. So where can we find you on social media?
I'm on Instagram at Knuckle Sandwich. Silly.
All right. You can get more of this podcast and me at thetheaterpodcast.com. You can show your support for the podcast at thetheaterpodcast.com/Patreon. Find me on Instagram and Twitter at theater_podcast. Please leave a rating and review wherever you're listening. This is edited by Matthew Hendershot. And thank you to Jukebox the Ghost for the intro and outro music. And Taylor, thank you most of all. This has been a lot of fun.
I know. Thank you so much for having me. What a thrill.
Take a deep breath, make the world a little colorful.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.